It is written, "Let him who is without sin cast the first pod." But he wasn't any fun at all. Instead, I'm Spider Robinson, and you found Spider on the Web number 27, being podcast, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. I'll read you an excerpt from my novel Time Pressure in just a bit, but I'm opening this week with a short but iconic and influential tune by the great guitarist Andrew York, Sunshine Rag. I was startled, not to mention grattered and flatified, to learn that just as I am an Andrew York fan, he's a Spider Robinson fan. That track is from an absolutely classic must-have CD he sent me years ago out of the blue called Perfect Sky. Andrew was one of the founding members of the famous Los Angeles guitar quartet, but let me tell you, it's a hell of a lot easier to hear him when there aren't three other dudes all playing at the same time. Here's a track from one of his more recent solo albums, Into Dark. Just in time for Christmas, at least by Spider standards, it's called Marley's Ghost.
Thank you.
That was Andrew York playing Marley's Ghost, and I hope you'll agree it's a dickens of a tune. Don't miss another New York CD, The Hauser Sessions, on which he plays Segovia's Personal Axe, a 1931 cedar top custom-built for the maestro by Hermann Hauser. For my money, Andrew achieves what I tried to accomplish with my collaboration with Robert Heinlein, Variable Star. He makes a much-missed master sing again. Find out more at www.andrewyork.net. Now, the solo novel I'm about to read from, Time Pressure, part of my Lifehouse trilogy, is set in Nova Scotia at the tail end of the 60s, so I'm going to set it up with one of the songs all us hippies used to sing together in them days that defines the era as well as anything else. Here's the amazing Jonathan Edwards with a live version of his famous chanty, Shanty.
We're going to lay around the shanty, you fat thing, and put a good buzz on.
That right. I'm happy to say Jonathan Edwards is still having fun these days at www.jonathanedwards.net. All right. In this excerpt from Time Pressure, our misanthropic hippie hermit hero, Sam, has just witnessed the explosive arrival of a beautiful, naked time traveler named Rachel in the snowy woods and brought her home to warm up. She says she's an anthropologist who has come back to study that turbulent era, And so, after consulting with his science fiction reading friend Snaker, Sam has agreed to introduce Rachel to the Snaker's commune, the Sunrise Hill Gang. We set off downhill along the twisting path. It was not shoveled, of course, but there were enough prior footprints to let us negotiate it with minimal difficulty. Before long, we came to the gingerbread house. I was not surprised that it wrung an actual smile out of Rachel. Picture the gingerbread house that Hansel and Gretel found. Now, alter it slightly to reflect the fact that it is constructed, brilliantly, if eccentrically, out of the remnants of a 100-year-old chicken coop, plus whatever came to hand. Malachi ceremonially destroyed his T-square and plumb bob before beginning construction. There isn't a right angle in the structure. Every single board had to be measured and hand-cut. There are nutball cupolas and diamond-shaped windows and a round door. No two shingles are the same size and shape. The first time I saw the GH, I thought of Bilbo Baggins. But no one was inside at the moment, so we kept following the path downhill and took the first left. Now the path was really downhill. Rachel, in unfamiliar boots, kept her footing expertly despite the large roots that lurked beneath the snow. It didn't seem likely that the skills of woodcraft could still exist in her fecton. I decided that she was just naturally graceful. We came to the bottom, to the stream. It's not a big stream. At full run, as now, you could have crossed it in three long strides and got wet to the knees. In summer, it sometimes disappeared for days at a time, leaving small, dwindling pools full of frantic fish. But it had pervasive magic about it. Its murmuring chuckle permeated everything, pleasing the ear in some subconscious way, conveying a kind of low-level ozone high. A footbridge spanned the stream, and the path continued downstream to our right, but we stopped on the near side and faced left to give Rachel and ourselves a chance to dig the waterfall. Snaker lit a pre-rolled cigarette and smoked it like it was a sacrament, blowing smoke to the four winds, Indian style. It was not a Niagara-type straight-drop waterfall, but a gradual cascade. A stepped escarpment of shattered rock turned the stream into 100 little waterfalls by which it dropped maybe 20 meters in the space of 5. White water for 3 mice in a boat. At the bottom, it regrouped and rushed off downstream to the sea. It wasn't really much noisier than the rest of the stream, just more trebly. It was prettier than hell, primevally delightful. Like the Fundy Shore, that waterfall was the kind of place that could ground you spiritually, lend perspective, bring your rushing thoughts to a temporary halt, and allow you to take stock. I breathed deeply through my nose, absently walking in place to keep my feet warm, and reflected that my friend the science fiction writing hippie and I were bringing a time traveler to Sunrise Hill for dinner. The three of us were sitting on what might very well be the deadliest secret that had ever existed, and we were about to introduce her, after 15 minutes briefing, to the nosiest customers to be found anywhere in the Annapolis Valley. I had not thought this through. It would be irony even beneath God's usual standards if it turned out that all of reality, every last human hope and aspiration, our time, were to be destroyed by the passion of a bunch of die-hard hippies for truth. Fuck it, if that is the final punchline, I told myself, then let's get to it. Let's go. It's getting late. Snaker looked around and nodded. Back up in the real world, the sun had not quite set, but down here in the holler, it was already getting dark. Right on, he agreed. And we tried to explain to Rachel what right on meant as we walked downstream to the treehouse. I despair of describing the treehouse. You have nothing to compare it to. The gingerbread house was an eccentric enough structure, but the treehouse made it look like a Levitt tract home. It was never designed, it simply occurred. Over a period of 3 years or so, 5 or 10 talented and twisted minds had, with no plan and little consultation, simply done whatever stoned them as materials or tools or willing labor became available, or as their individual spirits moved them. If a contribution by one of them foiled another's plan, he looked upon it as a bonsai challenge and rethought his concept. 3 of those minds belonged to expert carpenters, one of them world-class. Another co-creator couldn't have driven a nail if it had automatic transmission. The taste of all of them differed widely, but not sharply. As near as I can see, the only thing they all had in common was that each carefully considered the effect his efforts would have on the tree. A man Snaker's height could have just managed to walk underneath the house upright with a top hat on his head, though there were substantial areas where he could have safely used a trampoline. Of course the main floor was not level. What fun would that have been to build? Above the more or less first floor, the house bisected. Two asymmetrical structures wound up into different parts of the mighty rock maple tree, a substantial section of two additional stories, and a slimmer but taller one that had a tiny fourth-floor meditation chamber. One could travel between the two third floors by stepping up onto a window ledge and swinging across on a rope. There were strategically placed hand and footholds on the intervening tree trunk in case of screw-ups, and the drop to the roof below was not severe. The tree itself was magnificent. It continued on up another 15 or 20 meters above the highest point of the house, its two mighty arms in the attitude of a man caught yawning. There was not another tree that size in the holler, and I'll never understand why the loggers passed it over decades ago. Just possibly they had a sense of poetry in them somewhere. A tree has always seemed to me a sensible place to keep a house. You don't think so? Consider, in the winter you have plenty of sunshine, in summer plenty of shade. You have partial protection from rain and snow. There's never any standing water in the basement. When it's summer and the windows are open, birds wander in and out cleaning the kitchen floor. In winter, it takes one holy hell of a snowdrift to block your door, and you can haul up the gangplank if you want. I watched Rachel as we approached the treehouse. It's always interesting to catch people's first reactions to it. She had not commented on the gingerbread house. Perhaps odd and quaint and funky were not concepts that traveled well across the centuries, but I was willing to bet that any denizen of any human culture would find the treehouse striking. I was not disappointed. Her jaw did not actually drop, of course. She stopped walking and her nostrils flared. She raised first her right eyebrow, then her left, and stared at the place for a long 20 seconds. Snaker and I left her alone with it. Finally she smiled. It was the broadest, happiest smile I had seen yet on her face. She turned to us, her eyes shining. "Thank you, my first friends. This is a good place." We smiled at her, and then at each other, and then at her again. Snaker took a last puff on his cigarette and put it out. We moved on. When we were close, Tommy's voice rose faintly above the rushing stream sound. She was singing that John Prine song about blowing up your TV. As we passed between pilings and under the house, it emitted a man. Well, part of one. The cellar door dropped open suddenly, and I was looking right into the merry eyes of the Naz, no less unmistakable for being upside down, from a distance of perhaps 20 centimeters. He was grinning hugely. In future, unless I say otherwise, assume Naz is always grinning hugely. "Visual interface," he told me joyously. I couldn't argue. "Excuse me," he said. One arm emerged from the house carrying a long peavey. He reached down with it and opened the hatch of the root cellar by our feet. Then most of his torso emerged from the house. He made a long stretch and came up with a bag of turnips on the end of the peavey. He removed half a dozen or so, tossing them back up over his head, up and into the house. "Got to soak overnight." He dropped the sack back down into the root cellar, tipped the lid shut, sealed the anti-critter latch, and hauled himself partly back up so that he was at eye level with me again. "Pictorial, really. Evolved versus learned, right? Self-evident. Grox itself. Completely no operating system." The house reabsorbed him with a sound exactly like the one Farfel the dog used to make at the end of the word chocolate in the Nestle's commercials. Snaker and I looked at Rachel. She looked at us. We resumed walking. The Naz reappeared briefly behind us, said, "Hello, pretty lady," and was gone again before we could turn. There are several ways into the treehouse, but we took the elevator. It's a simple, open-air affair. You haul yourself up on a good block and tackle. We got on. I put my hands to the rope and, feeling faintly silly, as always, joined Snaker in the ritual shout that politeness demanded.
"Umgoa!"
And we hauled away as the shout echoed through the holler. Okay, it's dopey. When in Rome, you shoot off Roman candles. To an inhabitant of the treehouse, that shout means a fellow hippie is here. Rachel made no comment. We stepped off onto the porch, whacked snow from our pants, scraped and kicked it from our boots, untied our laces, and entered through the keyhole-shaped door. Snaker and I each took an armload of wood in with us from the stack on the porch, and Rachel followed our example. Just inside the door, we stepped out of our boots. There was welcome warmth, good smells of maple syrup and wood smoke and reefer, the sound of crackling fires. From the cheaply carpeted living room, I could see Tommy working in the kitchen. She was cleaning the sap taps. There are 8 set into the living wood of the kitchen wall, hoses running in parallel to a boiling pot on the stove. At the end of a day's run, it's a good idea to wash out the hoses. She turned and saw us through the kitchen doorway.
"Howdy," she called. "Far out. Good to see you, Sam. Be right there."
We added our firewood to the box by the living room stove, standing a few of the more snow-soaked sticks on end on the front of the battered old Franklin to dry. Rachel examined the room. It was furnished in rural hippie. Kerosene lamps. Candles. Psychedelic posters. Several mandalas. Macrame. Plants. An enormous and functional brass nargile with 4 mouthpieces. Cushions, cable drum tables, a superb old rocking chair painted paisley, Zen epigrams printed on the walls here and there, an arresting painting of rubies, a portrait of Malachi, a wrinkled print of Stephen Gaskin leading Monday night class at the Family Dog, a hand-sewn sampler depicting a field of daisies and bluebells surmounted by the legend, "Flowers eat shit." Along one wall, a shelf was lined with paperbacks that all concerned cosmic consciousness and how to achieve or sustain it. Tommy came in, wiping her hands on her shirt. "Hi," she said to Snaker and me, and then a separate friendly "Hi" to Rachel. "What's happening, guys?" she went on. "Was that one of them damn hunters again? We thought maybe y'all got shot for a moose." The Sunrise Hill gang don't seem to have the custom of introductions. A newcomer is welcome to introduce herself, or not, as suits her. If she chooses to wait a bit, perhaps pick a name that's not being used already, that's her business. "Nah," Snaker said. "It was Blue Meanie blowing a tire." "Far out," she said, grimacing sympathetically. "Well, looks like it was a good landing. You walked away. Is it in the ditch?" "Well, it happened just as we were slamming the doors, thank you, Buddha." "Wow, that's far out." Her eyes sparkled. "What a trip." "Well, tires are total, no spare, so I guess we hiked to dinner." She shrugged, a gesture that thrust her chin out and flounced her red curls. "Far out. I don't know if I'm into dinner. Ruby's making chili." "Hey, Naz, quit doodling. Get your coat. Ruby's making chili tonight." The Naz's bushy head appeared around the kitchen doorway. "Out of state," he called. "Just a third." When Naz uses cliches, they come out all wrong. He doesn't do it to be cute. It's just a mental short circuit. Tommy was already half-dressed for outdoors.
"Did you bring a guitar, Sam?"
"Left her in the truck."
"Well, I'll help you carry it, or Snaker will take my flute. You look real cute with your hair short like that, hon. I think I might try that myself."
When two women meet, they size each other up. It's not necessarily a competitive thing. They just take each other's measure. Men do it, too, but they do it differently, and I'm not sure how it's different. Women seem to take a little longer. They don't rely as much on sight, but I don't know what they use in its place. "It will look very good on you," Rachel said, and I knew they were going to be friends. Which was nice, because Tommy weirded out a lot of women, particularly ones as emphatically feminine as Rachel. Even with her long and curly red hair, Tommy could easily have passed for a teenage boy. Her flat-chested, hipless body, her manner, and many of her mannerisms were masculine. She blended right in with the construction crew. She was by no means a lesbian. She was the only true neuter human being I've ever known. She had absolutely no sex drive whatsoever, and by that point in her life, her mid-30s, she had long since given up pretending or minding. She told me about it the night I made my pass. No physiological dysfunction, no hard childhood trauma. She simply wasn't interested. She was quite capable of orgasm, an experience she likened to a sneeze, both in intensity and desirability. She was baffled and amused by the importance everyone placed on it, convinced that it was enormously overpriced at best. This placed a certain basic gulf between her and many other women, not to mention many men. City folk in particular, sex-charged to the point of frenzy by media hype, frequently resented her. But Rachel seemed to take to her instantly, and Tommy, once she was sure it was genuine, responded. I was slowly getting it through my head that Rachel was not what I thought of as city people, that, in spite of the logic of a million science fiction stories, the future was not necessarily going to urbanize to the point of inhumanity. Whatever it was like when she came from, they were still flexible and tolerant, which city folk in my experience were not, including myself when I first came up here. The Naz came bustling into the room, beaming and brandishing computer paper. Lord Buckley once said of his namesake, the carpenter kitty from Bethlehem,
"Naz had them pretty eyes. He wanted everybody to see out his eyes so they could see how pretty it was."
And it suited this Naz as well. He sweetened the climate where he was at. He waved 2 sheets of computer paper at us.
"It just now came to me," he said. "Check 'em out.
He handed me one. Final letter that was sent to Hewlett-Packard on February 18th. I looked at the sheet. It was a printed list of about 50 computer files, displaying title, type of file, date of creation, last modification, and size in bytes, arranged alphabetically by title. I ran my eye down the list. There were 10 files with Hewlett-Packard, or HP, in their title. 6 of those seemed to be letters. The second from the bottom was dated 18 Feb. Right here, I said, pointing. 4.9 seconds, Naz announced happily, looking up from a stopwatch. Grady, here, find it again. He handed me the second sheet. I blinked at it. It was hand-drawn. The same approximate number of files were represented by arrays of little pictures in groups with meticulously printed labels beneath each. Little three-ring binders indicated reports. Little tear sheets were article extracts. The little envelopes were obviously letters. My eye went to them at once. Beneath the pictures were the names, and HP18F leaped up at me. There, I said. 1.8 seconds, 63% faster. Far fucking up. Visual interface, Snaker said wonderingly. Pictorial, really. Hard on, Naz agreed. See, the ability of the brain to interpret text is learned behavior no older than the pyramids, but the brain's been interpreting pictures from in front. Much older circuitry, much faster traffic flow, much more information density. It's why movies kill books. Your face and breasts are extremely beautiful. This last, obviously, was to Rachel. She was not at all taken aback. Your hands and mind are extremely beautiful, she said. They smiled at each other. Two more friends. Let's go eat, I said. I was starving. Remind me to call Palo Alto when we get to the hill, Naz said. A couple of guys I want to mention this to. Less intimidating than a bunch of text in that damn ugly computer font. It's friendlier. Need a whole new language, though, and one of those new 8-bit chips. Crash, didn't he something? Tommy said admiringly. Get such a kick out of little pictures. Oh, they're going to change the world, he assured her. Yeah, for sure. So's Ruby's chili. Come on. We filled up the Franklin while Naz found his poncho and all left together. The sun was below the trees on our left, throwing long shadows across the Wellington Road to the trees on the other side. We walked in the ruts that trucks and cars had made in the snow. Usually there were just the two, right down the center of the road, but infrequently there was a place where two vehicles had met and managed to pass each other. The trip from the Holler to Sunrise Hill can be done in 5 minutes, if you don't mind falling on your face on arrival. It took us nearer 20. It was beginning to get cold out, making the footing slippery. Gertrude the guitar slowed me down. And the Naz lit a joint, an enormous spliff which he said he had been saving for a special occasion. He always says that. Always means it, too. To pass a doobie on slippery surface, you have to stop, so everyone else has to stop to wait for you, and eventually it seems sensible to just form a circle. So we did. Rachel joined it, but politely refused the joint. Perhaps later, she murmured, and the Naz beamed at her. The rest of us shared it in silence. The forest on either side of me began to sparkle. The random dance of shadows on branches suddenly became a pattern that teetered on the edge of recognition. I was suddenly aware of my position, clinging to the face of a vast spinning planet whirling through the universe. I heard the stream behind me, every leaf that fluttered for 100 meters in any direction, the sounds of birds and a deer to the north. My friends became Robin Hood's merry men, and I was very hungry.
Good shit, brother, I said to the Naz.
My voice came from 100 miles away through a filter that removed all the treble. He beamed.
Xerox Park.
Snaker broke up. Xerox Park? Like where people go to reproduce? We all cracked up.
No, man, Naz said. Xerox P-A-R-C. On the coast, man. Palo Alto. Dude that gave me this weed works there. Synchronicity, man. He'll freak when I tell him about my flash. All I need now is a way to point the stuff on the screen. Maybe that weird rat thing Doug came up with. Only make it a one-eyed rat.
None of us had the slightest idea what he was talking about. But you don't have to understand joy to share it. We congratulated him and finished the joint and resumed walking. The Wellington Road was a fairy wonderland, a winter carnival. Magic was surely in the air. And soon enough we came upon some. Mona and Truman's place came up on the right. Mona and Truman Bent were locals in their mid-40s, products of a century of inbreeding and poverty, and some of the nicest people I knew. If you're going to giggle about the name Bent, would you please do so now and get it over with? It's an extremely common and highly respected name in Nova Scotia, as are Butt and Raffuse and Why Not. Their home was a small showpiece of rural industry, ingenuity, and courage, inside and out. It sat close to the road with a little bit of a lawn and a swing set out front. A driveway led past it to the big, tired-looking barn in the back. Truman's immense one-ton truck was pulled halfway into the barn so he could work on the engine out of the weather. As with many properties on the North Mountain, the area around the barn was littered with almost a dozen wrecked vehicles and their guts, but the garden beyond the barn and the area around the house itself were neat as a pin. Mona is a fuss budget and tough as cast iron. And a sweetheart. When we were close enough to recognize what was lying in the center of her driveway right by the road, we stopped in our tracks. "Oh, wow, man," Tommy said. "Is that far out or what?" Snaker agreed. Naz shivered with glee. "Right on, Mona!" The Bents kept a pair of old tires on either side of their driveway with flower boxes set into the hubs. In summer, they brightened the driveway considerable. In winter, they were usually buried under snow. Mona had evidently had Truman dig one up, remove the empty flower box, and leave the tire in the middle of the drive. "I don't understand," Rachel said. "They heard our tire blow," I explained. "That one's for us."
"How do you know that?"
I shook my head. "I just do. Come on, I'll show you." Sure enough, there was a note stuffed into the hub.
"This ain't much, but it will get you to the gas station, I guess."
"See, there she is in the window," Tommy said.
We all waved our thanks to Mona. She gave a single wave back. Snaker pantomimed that we would pick the tire up on our way back from dinner, and she waved again, then closed her curtains. "Wow," Snaker said, "we got to do something nice for those people."
"Right field," Naz agreed. "Let's get the whole family thinking on it."
We trudged on. "Mona and Truman are amazing people," I told Rachel. "They can't have kids, so they foster parent. Constantly. There's always five or six kids around the place. She's strict as hell with them, and they always worship her. She'll take retarded kids, kids that are dying, kids that are crippled, whatever the agency sends. There are a couple of social workers that would die for her."
"And as you can see," Snaker called back over his shoulder, "she's adopted the whole goddamn Sunrise Hill gang."
"I look forward to meeting her," Rachel said.
"She's a trip," Naz called. "You'll love her."
"I already do," Rachel said, so softly that only I heard.
It was only another half a click before the forest on the left side of the road ended and we were come to Sunrise Hill. We all came to a halt again because the sun was just setting over the bay. Rachel took my hand and Snaker's. After a time we roused ourselves, trudged past an acre of snow-covered garden and came to Sunrise itself, also called the Big House. It was a simple wood-frame two-story, perhaps 50 years old, a much more conventional structure than either the gingerbread or tree houses, and larger than both of them put together. Unlike them, it stood right by the roadside in the middle of 5 or 6 more or less cleared acres. The only external signs of hippie aesthetic were the small sprouting greenhouse built onto the house in front and a solar shower in back. 50 meters back from the house, and about the same distance apart, stood a small cedar-shaped tool shed and a smaller outhouse. Between them was an ancient Massey Ferguson tractor covered by an orange tarp, and next to that an even more ancient one-lung make-or-break engine under a black tarp. We entered through the usual woodshed airlock, which also contained a wheezing old freezer and huge sacks of grains and beans. Inside, the big house looked much more like a hippie dwelling. The downstairs was a single enormous room with a giant front-loader wood stove at either end. The bare wood floor was completely covered with a once brightly colored painting, now faded, involving rainbows, dragons, and an immense myopic eyeball that stared biliously at the ceiling. The parts that Ruby had done looked great. On the left, a J-shaped counter and a small cook stove defined the kitchen. On the immediate right, a stupendous table, which had begun life as the west wall of a boat shed, defined the dining room and conference area. On its surface was painted a large, vivid sunrise. Assorted, wretched chairs lined one side of it. The other was a single homemade bench 3 meters long. Beyond that, an open staircase took 2 zigs and a zag to reach the upstairs. Past the staircase was open area. Beanbag chairs, ratty cushions, cable drum tables, shelves of hippie books, milk crates full of this and that, drying herbs hanging in bundles from the overhead rafters, a bunch of Ruby's canvases arrayed by the east window, a small shrine to the Buddha in the far right corner. The kitchen window was the only one on the north, or bay side. It let in enough of the glory of sunset to make the enameled sunrise on the table even more vibrant, but it was getting time to fire up the kerosene lamps. Both fires were roaring away, with a lot of birch in the mix, and the whole building was suffused with the overwhelming fragrance of simmering chili. Ruby turned as we entered, left off pumping water, and made a beeline for Snaker, drying her hands on her apron as she came. I liked to watch those two meet. Their joining was like slapping together two chunks of uranium. The energy levels of both went through the ceiling. I envied them. When they were done hugging and kissing and making small sounds of contentment, Ruby backed away. She looked Rachel up and down, smiled, and opened her arms again. Rachel took the cue. "Hi, I'm Ruby," Ruby said over Rachel's shoulder. "Hi, I'm Rachel," Rachel said over hers. They disengaged in stages, first pulling back to hold each other by the upper arms, then backing away further until their hands joined, then separating altogether, a spontaneous and oddly graceful movement. "Welcome to Sunrise Hill," Ruby added. "That's a beautiful headband." Rachel thanked her gravely. "Hi, guys," she said to the rest of us. "You're just in time. Dinner's nearly ready. Somebody set the table, a dish towel for everybody. Somebody else pump water and get the cider. Somebody give a hoot out back for the others. Rachel, you sit. You're a guest. Sam, I could dig some music. Would you mind picking a little?"
"Not if the snaker can join me."
"Well," she said, glancing at him, "I had some other uses in mind for his hands, but that's a choice I'll never confront him with. Go ahead, babe. Oh, yeah, was it the Beatles?"
Snaker pulled a blank. So did I, and it was up to Rachel to save the situation.
"I think we are agreed it is not. The drumming is too good to be either Pete Best or Ringo, and the accents are wrong. But it's an excellent fake."
Ruby nodded and said, "Too bad," and went back to the kitchen area. Snaker and I exchanged a glance and mimed sighs. We had forgotten the excuse we'd originally used to get Snaker over to my place without mentioning the time traveler.
"Well," I said, unpacking my guitar, "there's the old philosophical question as to why a near-perfect forgery isn't as good as the real thing."
And we jawed about that while Snaker and I got tuned together and warmed up with instrumental blues in E. Ruby scattered along with us. As Tommy came in with her younger brother, Malachi and Sally and Lucas, we were just starting that Jonathan Edwards song about laying around the shanty and getting a good buzz on, and everybody joined in on that one. When it was done, the table was set, Ruby was in the final stages of her magic-making, and there was barely time for a verse of Leon Russell's Soul Food before supper was on the table. As the lid came off and the smell reached us, Snaker and I stopped in the middle of a bar and put away our axes. There were 4 loaves of fresh bread, 2 whole wheat and 2 rye, baked Tassajara style. There were about 15 liters of cider in one of the ubiquitous white buckets with a dipper. There was an equal amount of well water in another bucket. There was a bowl big enough to be the hubcap off a 747 overflowing with lettuce-based salad, another full of carrot flake and raisin salad. 4 homemade dressings. There were great bulk-purchase slabs of margarine. The Sunrise Gang were strict vegetarians. There were tamari and brewer's yeast and tofu and peanuts and sprouts and tahini and a little bit of soybean curry from the day before. To accommodate all this, there were plates and bowls and mugs and silverware, no items matching, and in the center of the table, in a pot large enough to boil a missionary, were about 30 liters of Ruby's chili. When we dug in, the table was groaning and we each had a dish towel of our own. A while later, the dish towels were all saturated with sweat and we were doing the groaning. And grinning.
"Is there a recipe written down for this, hon?"
Snaker asked his lady, gulping cider.
"Sure," she said. "You better destroy it. It's evidence of premeditation."
She threw a piece of bread at him. Between the happy cries of the scorched and the clatter of utensils and the roar of 8 conversations going on at once and the growling hiss of the stoves and the thunderous volley of farts that attends any gathering of vegetarians, we made the rafters of the old house ring. Nonetheless, most of my sense memories of the occasion are oral. Ruby made good chili, so good I actually didn't miss the meat. I never did get to observe Rachel meeting Malachi, Lucas, or Sally. It must have occurred at some point when my eyes were watering and the wax was running out of my ears. I did notice that while Rachel shoveled in chili as rapidly as the rest of us, she didn't begin screwing up her face in good chili spasm until all of us had been doing so for a while, and didn't begin to sweat until a few minutes after that. By the end of the meal, she had it down. We drank the cider and water buckets dry and another bucket and a half of water. We ate everything on the table, save for perhaps 5 liters of chili, which tomorrow would be folded into chapatis for lunch. And then the conversations all trailed off into heartfelt compliments to Ruby, and there was a moment or two of silent, respectful appreciation, a contemplation of contentment, and a sharing of that awareness. Shadows danced by kerosene lamplight. The simmering of dishwater on the stove became the loudest sound in the house. Lucas broke the silence with a diaphragm deep "Om." Malachi and Snaker picked it up at once, an octave higher, Malachi on the tonic, Snaker on the dominant. The rest joined in raggedly in whatever octave was easiest for them, and the sound swelled and rose and steadied as we all sat up straighter and got our breathing behind it.
Have you ever done an om with a large group of people? Large enough that the drone chant takes on a life of its own and doesn't ever seem to change as individual chanters drop out to inhale? If you have not, put this book down and go find 10 or 15 people who aren't too hip to learn something and give it a try. So many things happen on so many levels that I'm not sure I can explain it to you. On a musical level alone, the experience is edifying. The harmonics are fantastic, and they actually get a little better if one or two folks can't carry a tune so good and the note hunts a little. On a physiological level, there's a surprisingly strong tranquilizing effect. The aum syllable is the oldest breath-regulating chant on the planet, basic and irreducible and auto-hypnotic. On an emotional level, it's together-bringing and happy-making. It's proverbially impossible to get any three people to agree on what time it is. To get 10 or 15 together on even something as simple as a single pure sound is exhilarating. If you om with people you don't know, you'll be friends when you're done. If you do it with friends. On a spiritual level, well, if you're alive in the 1980s, you probably don't believe there is such a thing, so I won't discuss it. Just try an om sometime before you die. Come to it as cynically as you like. Sunrise ohms were just a trifle frustrating for me, though, at that point in history. When the group had first spontaneously formed a few years before, the ohms were the best I'd ever been in, before or since. Partly because we had more participants, nearly 30 that summer, but mostly because the ohms were free-form improv, an unrestricted outpouring of the heart. Those who were not musicians, the majority of us, of course, held onto the tonic or dominant to keep us all centered, and those with musical skill jammed around the basic drone, sometimes adding harmonies to make chords and then spontaneously mutating them in weird, shifting ways, sometimes throwing in deliberate and subtle dissonances, then resolving them creatively, sometimes doing raga scales or Ray Charles gospel riffs or whatever came out of our heads and hearts in mutual interaction. The results were always interesting and frequently breathtaking. But of late, the Sunrise Hill had typically gotten a little too spiritually conservative, read tight-assed, and had decided that having people chant all over the place offered too much encouragement to ego, a word which had for them roughly the same emotional connotation that commie held for their parents. Surely ego was out of place in a spiritual event. So the current agreement was to limit the om to the tonic and dominant notes. That was more democratic, more pure, more basic and simple. Also more boring. And as a guest, I was, of course, required by politeness to conform and listen to my own solos only in my head. It itched me a little, and I knew it itched Snaker, too, because we'd discussed it. Still, any om is better than no om, and I was simply too well-fed to sustain irritation. So I settled into contemplation of the sound we were making, and Rachel began to improvise. Brilliantly, from the very first riff, I hadn't been fully aware until then that she was participating in the om, but Jesus, you couldn't miss her warm honey alto when she started to blow. It was something like the sudden appearance of a darting trout in a pellucid pool, and a shared thought chain flashed around the table in an instant. What the? Oh, it's cool. She's a stranger, doesn't know any better. Jesus, listen to her. Do it! As she wove a strange liquid melody line around her drone, and after a very slight staggered hesitation, the om steadied and came back in strong behind her. Well, the ice having been broken by the guest, I wrestled with the part of me that Malachi insisted was my ego, and went into the tank. When my current breath ended, I sucked in a joyous deep new one, paused an instant, and took off after her. Her eyes met mine, and we both thought of our lovemaking that afternoon, and wrapped our voices around each other. We did a modal thing, started it simple, cluttered it a bit, brought it home again, measuring each other, feeling each other out, alto and my baritone seeking harmony. And I caught Snaker's eye and lifted my brows, and he took a deep breath and jumped in an octave above me, duplicating my line to show that he understood what was happening. Ruby hesitated a few seconds and then began to parallel Rachel's line, and we all looked to Rachel, and at her signal we banked sharply and cut in the afterburners, riding that magic carpet of drone like the blue angels heading for the clouds in perfect, wordless communication. And a long, happy, indescribable time later it was over, the statement was made, it hung in the air and in our mind's ear like a sky-written mandala, hung and spread and drifted and dissipated as the last breath of the last voice, Tommy's, ran out. We all smiled in silence together for a long time, too happy to speak. It was clear to us that God had been here and gone, but that was okay, he'd be falling by again sometime.
Well, that was far out, Malachi said at last, and from the tone of his voice I knew we were in for a session.
Well, Rachel had to meet him sometime or other. It sure was, Ruby said, ignoring the subtext of his tone with the long practice of an ex-lover. She was smiling dreamily at Snaker. He was going to be very glad he had been a good boy at my place earlier.
Right up, Naz agreed, also oblivious.
Malachi pounced.
Well, it's far out how something can happen spontaneously like that, and it's a stone that one time, 'cause like perfect for the moment, you know?
Malachi had the mad, burning eyes of a born saint or poet or revolutionary, though he was none of these, deep-set eyes smoldering under shelves of forehead like banked coals at the back of deep caves. He could disappear into the woodwork when he wanted, but when he put on his guru voice, he drew attention effortlessly.
Rachel didn't know our custom about not hamming up the homes, but that's far out, because she brought good vibes to the party, and that's what counts, even if we wouldn't want to home that way all the time.
I'd like to home that way all the time, Snaker said with just a little edge.
I think we have agreement on that, Malachi said softly.
To my surprise, Lucas spoke up.
Maybe we should examine the agreement.
He was staring at Rachel.
Malachi rolled with it.
Far out, maybe we should.
Lucas was wearing weights strapped to his wrists and ankles for three reasons. Because it was good physical exercise, because it was good spiritual discipline, and because it hurt. Any of the three would have sufficed.
I could dig some more homes like that, once in a while anyway.
He looked away from Rachel suddenly.
I think I'd give my right arm if I could make my voice do that stuff.
Well, isn't that kind of why we made the agreement? Malachi asked, and one or two people began to nod.
What exactly do you mean by agreement? Rachel asked.
Malachi turned those gimlet eyes on her. When she didn't flinch, he seemed to smile slightly.
See, we're a spiritual community, so we have to make some basic agreements to live together and then stick to them. Like, it's our agreement to be strict vegetarian, and you can rap for days about whether that's far out or misguided, and we have, still do. But meanwhile, it's our agreement to do that thing, and so we do. And if that's a drag for some of us,
Snaker squirmed,
well, hopefully the spiritual solidarity from the agreement is worth the drag. The way you were oming, please don't think I'm laying blame. It was beautiful and you didn't know. But we used to om that way here, and we found that it was easy for it to turn into a kind of exclusive thing, almost an elitist trip. Like it divided us up into the talented and the drones, if you dig. It brought us apart instead of together, and we wanted an om that was more symbolic that we were all doing the same thing here, so we made that agreement. You see?
I'd been subconsciously expecting something like this for hours. I'd always found Malachi infuriatingly difficult to argue with. As they say around the mountain, he's slick as a cup of custard. And I just knew that Rachel was a match for him, that she was going to lay him out, stop his clock with some kind of splendid Zen epigram. And she sideswiped me.
I think that is a wise decision for you, she said. I will make that agreement with you all.
Snaker's jaw dropped, too. Ruby gave Rachel a closer look.
Malachi blinked.
Irritated at how often and easily Malachi could make me irritated, I spoke up.
Look, I have no agreements at all with you guys except the ones that come under being a good neighbor, but I'll tell you this. While that home was happening, I was part of God and totally stoned. Me too, Snaker said. And that seems like a silly thing for a spiritual community to turn away from.
Well, that's the trip, Sam, Malachi said with exasperating compassion. You were totally stoned.
Not everybody was. We want to all be part of God.
Well, I could see myself responding, but we were all stoned, and then going around the table. You were stoned, weren't you? Only by that time half of them would be wondering if they had in fact been stoned. Malachi had that effect on them, and I had climbed these stairs before. So had Snaker. He shot me a look that said, thanks for trying, brother.
Far out, I conceded reluctantly.
Clean up crew, Ruby said loudly and clearly. People began scraping plates and stacking them. I caught Rachel's eye and stood up. She took her cue and followed me to the sink. She was supposed to be from the city, so it was okay for me to lecture her on the art of dishwashing without running water. I don't think she'd ever washed a dish under any circumstances, but she was a very quick study. At one point, she should have burned her wrist on the hot water kettle, but the skin declined to burn. Malachi was nearby scraping leftovers into the compost bucket, but he didn't seem to notice. She and I traded off washing and drying while others cleared and washed the table and put away the dried dishes and stoked the fires and adjusted the lamps, and Ruby watched in regal contentment. One of the commune's more sensible rules is that whoever cooks dinner gets to fuck off the rest of the night. Except that Ruby wasn't fucking off. She was 95% certainty thinking about her next painting. Though she was concentrating on the dishes, Rachel managed to take in the whole scene. One of her rare smiles lit her face.
This is beautiful, she murmured to me.
I looked around to see what she meant. I got it at once.
Many people working in concert, with no wasted words, moving at high speed but never bumping into each other, a marvelous improvised choreography. Calmness and activity, a perfect Zen dance. It was what attracted me to Sunrise Hill, this quality. If the place had been like that all the time, perhaps I'd have moved in. My irritation with Malachi leaked from me, and I began to enjoy myself again almost as much as I had during the Ohm. And then a strange and terrible thing happened. You've been listening to about a chapter and a half of Time Pressure, the second of three novels comprising the Lifehouse Trilogy by Spider Robinson, available in a new hardcover omnibus from Bain Books. One of the albums that was unquestionably played constantly by the Sunrise Hill Gang and every other hippie commune in existence then was David Crosby's stunning first solo album, which came out in 1970, shortly after he left the Birds. The title alone spoke to all hippies everywhere. If I could only remember my name. Not only was it the world's first clear taste of the truly astonishing things David could do with harmony, it was one of the first and greatest flowers of the communal spirit of the times that we've been talking about. It was recorded by a wizard named Stephen Barnhart in San Francisco, and over the course of the session, some of the greatest musicians on the planet wandered in. The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Carlos Santana's band, Joni Mitchell, David's own brother Ethan, who taught him guitar, David Freiberg, someone named David Geffen, and two chaps named Graham Nash and Neil Young were among those who laid down tracks at various times. The album was an instant classic. If you're my age, you probably have a vinyl copy. But you may not know that in 2006 it was reissued, and not just remastered by Stephen Barnhart, not just with a bonus track, but with something truly special. A second disc, a DVD, containing first a stereo mix in advanced resolution, 192K 24-bit and Dolby Digital, and second, the entire album in advanced resolution surround sound, Dolby Digital and DTS. David says it is simply the most perfect recording of acoustic guitar ever made, and I agree absolutely. I only wish I could play it for you in that kind of resolution. Take my word, it's an experience you'll never forget. Since I can't, here's that bonus track I mentioned, a spontaneous acoustic guitar improvisation duet by David and a friend. I love the spot just a little ways in where they both look at each other and crack up because they both know the magic has come to visit and they can't believe how good it feels. Here are two true greats, David Crosby and his friend Jerry Garcia, having fun with Kids and Dogs.
you can get signed or personalized copies of the Lifehouse Trilogy, Variable Star, or any other Spider Robinson title by contacting White Dwarf Books, www.deadwrite.com/wd.html. Dead Right is all one word, spelled DEADWRITE. Hope you'll come back next week for Spider on the Web number 28. For now, let's both go try to make somebody smile.